Kink, your palms are sweaty, and I'm barely listening
to Columbia House Party. Jake, what's going on, man?
The ASMR episode.
Yeah, I thought about it. This album has ASMR vibes.
That's true.
To it, man.
It really does.
Ben Gibbard's voice.
And our voices are tired. Yeah. So.
Not that at all. We were talking about this episode last night.
Yeah.
Burned through.
We remember some of it.
Yeah. As producer Dylan said, we can piece together what we talked about this album last night.
That's the entire purpose of the show.
Can we get it
What did we say on a Saturday night?
Can we get it one time in the chat for self-destructive behavior? No, last night was fun. I was on the fence because it had been like such a bad couple of mental health days. And
right.
Like, it's always like, to drag my ass out and actually go out.
Be social, do things.
Yeah, yeah. It can go two ways, especially adding alcohol to the mix. It can go two ways.
Yeah.
But it was nice.
It seemed like it was a good eve.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Some arguments about pizza and what is and isn't a pizza. If you thought is a hot dog a sandwich was annoying, our friend Zoobs, who you might remember from the Fall Out Boy from Under the Cork Tree episode, stormed out of the bar yelling
ranting
at us because I suggested the idea of an open-faced chicken pot pie. That's where that conversation ended up. We'll spare you some of the details.
I can't wait for Zoobs to hear this episode and get mad again. He'll have forgotten about it entirely and be like, oh, god damn it.
Thank you so much for coming along and listening with us. Or if you're new, welcome.
Yes,
all those old episodes are timeless. You can go back and listen to those too.
It's true. Those albums will never disappear.
Other than the banter at the beginning.
Yeah.
And
about,
us
the night before.
Yeah. And the one, us every week complaining about being a little hungover.
Yeah. It's like, Sunday mornings.
Yeah. That's what we get.
Yeah. It's our fault.
Last night being what it was, it's fine. We feel great. We're adults.
We got coffee. We're fine.
We can fight through it.
Coffee and water.
I could not fight through something that happened to me. Two things actually that happened to me while I was preparing for this episode.
Okay.
I was at the gym and I have an iPhone and you have to have that stupid little dongle thing to be able to put headphones into it.
Right.
Well, my music stopped working and I'm like, what the hell's going on? I have no interest in being at the gym.
Oh, being at the gym without music is a nightmare.
Yes. Especially at the start. Like I was early on.
Oh.
Anyway, so my headphones just stopped working and it turned out that like that little dongle, which I've only had for like 2 months, is just like frayed or whatever. And I had to get a new one. It's like it's such a scam. But the point being, I was ready to listen to the album over the course of a workout. And then I got nothing. I had to listen to the radio.
Ugh. I used to go to that gym, too. It's just that little boombox in the window, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. The second thing that happened to me while I was making my notes, I was out at a coffee shop. And Jake, I texted you about this because I had to talk to someone about it. There was a person reading aloud to themselves the entire time that I was working there.
It's just a nightmare. Like,
I don't understand.
It's a nightmare a lot so far today, but that's okay.
Yeah.
But also, don't read aloud in a coffee shop or in public.
Yeah.
Read like quietly. That's what reading's for.
And sorry to disappoint you. It did not turn into the meet cute that we thought it might.
Yeah. I was thinking it was going to be like a Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan situation, but it turned out to very much not.
Yeah, where we don't like each other at first, but then
it's like, oh,
serendipity strikes. And
exactly.
It was not one of those. Not yet, anyway. Maybe next time I'm at that coffee shop.
Maybe.
Speaking of movies like that, have you seen Someone Great on Netflix?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so it's a pretty good rom-com. It's Gina Rodriguez from Jane the Virgin and Lakeith Stanfield.
I like them both.
So, like, yeah, very good cast. Unbelievable soundtrack. Like, Mitski, Phoebe Bridgers, Lorde, Lizzo. Really, really good soundtrack. However, there's a scene where they're flashback to, I want to say it's 2011 or 2012, and they're talking about being at a festival where A$AP Rocky and the Postal Service have both performed, which, fine, you can suspend your disbelief a little bit. Festivals are weird. But as they're talking, someone refers to Ben Gibbard as the guy from the Postal Service, not the guy from Death Cab for Cutie. And I feel like no matter how popular the Postal Service were at any one minute, nobody in 2011 or 2012 would refer to Ben Gibbard as the guy from the Postal Service.
I don't think even when this album came out and it was popular, anyone would refer. And like Death Cab weren't that big yet.
No, it was pre-transatlanticism.
Like, yeah, it was still like, it's the guy from Death Cab.
Yeah. Anyway, cool to shoehorn that in there. It just seemed like a...
That is odd.
Like a little bit of a pretentious screenwriting wrinkle there.
I know Ben Gibbard's other extremely successful band that everyone knows.
Yes. And they rule.
Yeah, they're great.
The Postal Service are great. Last week, we talked about Desaparecidos and Connor Oberst. Connor is a rare artist who has actually more projects on the go than Ben Gibbard, who has his hands in a little bit of everything as well. Also, Chris Walla from Death Cab, who comes up in a bunch of our episodes.
He's going to come up in the next like 4 weeks.
Yes, a lot. Anyway, we talked about Connor, who had worked with Jimmy Tamborello on Dintel, a track called Breakfast in Bed. At that time, Tamborello, working under his DJ producer side named Dintel, D-N-T-E-L, if you don't know what that is and wanna look that up, he was doing a lot of things like having Connor on a track or having Gibbard on a track. Gibbard worked on a track called This Is the Dream of Evan and Chan. Not as I have it in my notes, This Is the Dream of Evan Chan. Evan Chan might be a guy. This was not his dream. This was a dream of Evan and Chan.
Also the inspiration for the great Final Fantasy song, This Is the Dream of Win and Regine.
About, I didn't know that.
Yeah, about What's Their Faces from Arcade Fire.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, that went so well between Tamborello and Ben Gibbard that they were decided, you know what, let's do something else together. They sat down and they were like, oh, what's the worst SEO we could possibly have for a band name? Short of Pup.
No one that's concerned about SEO in 2003.
No. Today, we're talking about an indie trio that formed to make a supergroup with a twist, exploring what was, for some band members, a new sound and a creative step forward. While the band would toy with the idea of a subsequent album, eventually reunite and then disband, this album holds an important place in each of their collective careers and in the mid-2000s indie pantheon. Today, we're talking about the 2003 album from the Postal Service, Give Up.
Smeared black ink. Your palms are sweaty, and I'm barely listening to last demands. I'm staring at the asphalt, wondering what's buried.
Around this time, so this came out in 2003, I probably found it 2004, 2005-ish. This was kind of the first, like, as my tastes expanded and moved around a little bit, the first thing that did have a DJ and was a little techier, other than, like, Air Force Ones by Nelly and Bugetto by Ali and Murphy Lee. Like, those were the
what
only...
What about DJ Lethal?
Nah. It wasn't about that stuff. So that was my first... This was my first foray into that side of things. And I used to... In university, I had to have something on when I was studying or working. Mm-hmm. But most of the music I listen to is very lyric heavy, and you can't really read or write when there's a lot of lyrics coming at you. I know some people use like EDM or classical music or whatever. This was a nice middle ground for me. Obviously, Gibbard's vocals are really strong, so once you know the songs, it's a little distracting like that. But at first, it's just like, okay, it's soft singing over cool beats, and then like Jenny Lewis comes in with some harmonies, and it's like, yeah, that could be on in the background a lot while I'm reading or doing stuff.
Until you mentioned this to me the other day about this idea of it like being the first sort of electronic-esque album you got into, I hadn't really considered that for myself, and I don't know if it's true for me, but I think I'm a bigger electronic music fan than you are now.
Yeah.
I certainly wasn't when I first heard this album.
Yeah, I more went a synth pop route with it eventually.
Yeah, I'm curious as to whether this album did sort of like subconsciously plant that taste.
Gateway.
Yeah, but like without it being direct. So it was such a large gap between when I heard this album and when I got into electronic music. So I wonder.
Jake's holding his arms out really wide right now. You should see the wingspan.
Such wingspan.
He's trying
on my
to
tiny,
highlight
tiny
this
frame.
Gap with his.
Now I'm just dancing.
Wait, 5 foot six with a 7 foot wingspan?
Oh, you're being generous of my height. But it was like, I wonder now if it's when I got into electronic music, if I was like, oh, I recognize this kind of sound because I like the Postal Service, like unconsciously, maybe.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
You have that barrier to entry removed because you've heard something that you've liked something that sounds like that before, right?
Exactly.
This was also on top of sonically being unique at that time and to your point, kind of a gateway. It also, it fit the moment as kind of, you know, here's some more Ben Gibbard sad boy anthem. It's not all sad. It does like fit that moment of, hey, over here, emo and pop punk are kind of expanding and exploding. And hey, over here in the indie scene, like Death Cab is about to come up. And also here's the Postal Service. And
yeah,
there's a lot going
on. Also and, a like, weirdly timed record in terms of their career.
We'll get into how what the writing process was like for them and the recording process. But while they were doing this, Gibbard was also writing Transatlanticism. Man, because Death Cab was on a little bit of a break.
What a prolific year for someone to write this record and also write Transit.
They come out in the same year.
Yeah, like, that's wild.
Gibbard told Sub Pop in 2013, if somebody were to talk about that year, the year that indie rock broke, it would probably be the fall of 2003. With The Shins or with Death Cab or Modest Mouse or whatever, all of a sudden this culture that we had been a part of kind of quietly, without any ambitions, without any expectations that there would be any kind of mainstream success, we all of a sudden became sucked up into mainstream culture in this way that at the time was really unexpected. Which, yeah. Well said, Ben.
Yeah, man. We'll see.
You have, at this point, these three people doing their own things that would ultimately be pretty successful. We talked about Jimmy Tamborello doing Dintel. He also played bass in a band that I saw described as Brian Enocore. they were called Strictly Ballroom, but he was mostly focusing on DJ and producing. He had, you know, people like Gibbard and Oberst and Hayden all on a 2001 album called Life is Full of Possibilities. He got like a bit of a cult following in the electronic scene, and the success of his collaborations kind of got him thinking, hey, maybe I could do a little bit more. That's one arm of this. The second arm is Jenny Lewis, who was a child actress turned vocalist slash keyboardist slash guitarist slash bassist in Rilo Kiley, and was basically like, hey, if I'm in this band, I'm the lead singer, and like I would like to be the main part of a project for a change. And at that time, Rilo Kiley was like kind of shifting from their country-ish sound to more of the indie sound, like around the Execution of All Things in 2002. So she's going through an important transition with her main project. And then you have Gibbard, who was, of course, on the rise with Death Cab for Cutie. Death Cab song. So Death Cab, around that time, they released a photo album. There was some tension in the band and they decided to take a break. So Gibbard was able to look at some potential other projects because of the way this would be recorded. In late 2002, he was working on Transatlanticism, which was obviously Death Cab's breakthrough hit. It seems a little odd now, the timing of it all. And it's very similar to Oberst and Desparcidos being this side project he did right before Bright Eyes blew up. Tamborello and Gibbard get together and they do the This is the Dream of Evan and Chan. It's really well received, you know, and even that came about. So weird connection. Tamborello's roommate had toured with Death Cab and Ben was staying at their place.
Oh.
And Tamborello was just like, hey, like, you want to mess around? And like, what do you think of this?
Oh, really?
And then that's it.
I didn't know that.
Then they recorded it. Yeah.
Huh.
So the song was well received. The two liked working together. They were thinking about like a smaller scope EP, but then Sub Pop started kicking the tires on it. And obviously if Sub Pop is interested, you start thinking, hey, maybe this could be an album. Initially, Lewis was just going to help with some vocals, and then they looped her in as a full member of the band. They came together to form the Postal Service. And after this, we'll talk about that album, Give Up. All right. So that does well. They're like, hey, we'll do a whole album. Jenny Lewis will help out on it.
Just casually have Jenny Lewis show up and help out.
They had never even met. Rilo Kiley shared a label with Death Cab, and they were like, hey, you
want
to do this?
They were on Barsook, I think. Was that it? Was that the
label?
I feel like that was like the West Coast version of Saddle Creek.
So yeah, they were just like, at one point, I forget which interview it was in, Jenny Lewis said that like they were so unfamiliar with each other that like when Rilo Kiley picked Ben up from the airport, he was holding a sign with his own name on it so they would know who he is. Jen Wood, formerly of Tattletale, also does some vocals on the album. A lot of people get involved because how weird the process was. Chris Walla from Death Cab for Cutie, also very involved on the Gibbard side. The band's name, The Postal Service, comes from how the songs were produced. Because everyone had other commitments that precluded them from being in the studio together, Tamborello wrote and made instrumental tracks. He then mailed the digital audio tapes to Sub Pop, and then Gibbard would pick them up, edit them as he saw fit, add his melodies and his vocals, mail them back to Tamborello. The irony here being that apparently they did not actually use the U.S. Postal Service. They used UPS or FedEx. Gibbard told Sub Pop in 2013, all the songs were written pretty quickly. He would send me a disc with two songs on it, and then I would turn them around within a week or two. For whatever reason, I was just really responding to what he was sending me. It all seemed pretty easy. Tamborello sends a track over. Gibbard gets in the studio with Chris Walla. Chris Walla throws down some guitar and piano and helps on the production side. Then they send it right back. So an A&R, Tony Kuehl for Sub Pop, said it was one of the cheapest records Sub Pop has ever made. At that time, they had about a $50,000 budget for Hot Hot Heat, The Shins, Iron and Wine, David Cross, and The Postal Service.
Wow, that is a 2003 ass lineup.
Also, the return on investment for that $50,000.
And a movie once told me The Shins would change my life, so.
Yeah, we will talk about that. That piece of work. Gibbard told Entertainment Weekly, I say this without any ego, but making Give Up was incredibly effortless. There was little struggle. Everything we tried worked. There wasn't a lot of hand-wringing and hair-pulling out. It was just this moment that was very inspired and unique. You know, a lot of the albums we've done, there's drama or there's difficulty in the writing process or recording process or whatever. These guys are just like, nah, we're pros. We're here. I trust you. I'll mail you some songs.
And
throw
like,
some
why
vocals
would,
on it.
Like, with the talent involved, why
wouldn't
you?
Yeah, especially knowing who these people are now. Like, at the time, maybe they weren't as... Tamborello was probably the most established of the three in his role at that point.
I think it's interesting, too, listening to it today, considering how these songs were written in terms of this just, like, mailing back and forth and, like, Tamborello just sending instrumental tracks. Ben Gibbard is an outstanding songwriter.
Yeah.
Like the strength of this whole album is just him being like, I'm writing songs over your beats.
Yeah.
And they're all so good.
It's crazy. It's crazy that it worked that well. One thing that didn't work well, the name. This goes beyond my SEO problems with it. The U.S. Postal Service sent a cease and desist.
Really?
Can't use that name. It was settled without going to court when the band agreed to play at a U.S. Postal Service conference. They also sold the album in USPS's online store. So
amazing.
Tamborello told Pitchfork in 2008, it was really weird when we found out we had to do it. It was really depressing and it kind of freaked me out. I already don't like flying, and flying to play a show for people who probably aren't going to care. We only played two songs. It just seemed like a crazy trip. But then when we did it, it ended up being kind of fun. We just played this sort of jokey intro and came out. I think we talked to the Postmaster General for a minute. Then we sat at a table and played two songs and everybody else was sitting in chairs.
That's so weird.
Yeah. So they basically said like it felt like a press conference and then they had to do the reception after. But like everyone was in on the joke of like how ridiculous it was.
Okay.
So it ended up being not that bad a time. They get through this weird recording process. They handle the U.S. Postal Service stuff. Sub Pop releases it on February 18th, 2003, along with acoustic covers from their other artists to draw more attention to it.
Oh.
A little worried maybe that because it was different, maybe a little worried about it catching people's attention. So there are other bands like Iron and Wine and The Shins.
Oh, that's where all those came from.
All Sub Pop acts.
Oh, I didn't know. I just assumed they were like, I like this song. I didn't know that it was like a label instituted thing. Interesting.
Yeah, so they came out around the same time.
Okay, so that makes sense because I remember when I first heard the Iron and Wine cover of Such Great Heights. I think I actually heard that before I heard the
Probably
Postal Service.
Because you were such a huge Garden State fan.
Maybe. But I remember...
Zach Braff.
We'll get into that one day, I'm sure. I remember hearing that and being like, oh, cool. Like, this sounds like that Iron and Wine song. And but I had no idea that it was like part of the same package. I assumed it was just a cover.
Yeah, it was a rollout.
Interesting.
You know, that obviously makes for a weird scenario where they release an album, but other people's versions of their songs are as popular initially.
Yeah, that is odd.
The Shins had that moment where it was like, oh, The Shins covered something? Like,
Man,
the Shins had a moment. And
they absolutely those. What are the, what's that album? Shroots Too Narrow, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, so the actual album that the Postal Service did, not the covers, you know the sound. It's kind of this synth pop new wave mashup. Gibbard's vocals just fit perfectly to your point about how seamlessly this all fits together. It's kind of a fun contrast between his vocals and melodies, and then you have these synths around it, and then harmonies with Lewis. It just there are like different fun different components to each song, and they all kind of fit together. Gibbard's songwriting was like a little uncharacteristic for him, even though all these songs lyrically sound like Death Cab songs. Only three of the songs were written from his own perspective, like autobiographically. The rest were kind of, you know, out thinking outside of himself. One of them is even positive, which is...
It's weird for him.
Yeah. And you could tell it's outside of his comfort zone. AllMusic's Heather Ferris reviewed it and said it has more emotional heft than you might expect from a synth pop album. Normally, we save reviews till the end of the album talk, but I thought that's a good way to tee it up. More emotional heft than you might expect from a synth pop album. Well, yeah, because Death Cab is on the synth pop album, you know, and a couple of these tracks could be Death Cab tracks. You cut down the synths a little bit. And
but I think that's also what made it so accessible and successful, that people who were into Death Cab, because Death Cab was about to have their like big moment, being like, oh, this is not that different from what I like.
Which is not what they maybe expected at first. Tamburello thought they'd be a little bit more experimental, but then it kind of just became a pop album, with the exception of the opening of Brand New Colony, which, you know, if you're out there getting some coins or jumping on some turtle shells, you know, that might be your jam.
I'll be the grapes fermented, bottled and served, with the table set in my finest suit, like a perfect gentleman. I'll be the fire escape that's bolted to the ancient brick, where you will sit and contemplate your day. I want to take you far from the cynics in this town and kiss you on the mouth. We'll cut our bodies free from the tethers of this scene. Start a brand new colony where everything will change. We'll give ourselves new names. Identities erased. The sun will heat the grounds under our bare feet in this brand new colony. This brand new colony.
Once you get through that intro, just another really good The Postal Service song. And that's pretty much the story of the album, is that a lot of these songs are just really good. Let's go through a couple. We'll rank them later, but I think unpacking three of these songs gives you a pretty good idea of what the album is. Probably, I won't say my favorite because we're going to debate those a little later. Nothing Better might be the most interesting in terms of lyrical content. So Nothing Better is a duet where Jen Wood comes in. A little weird to look back now that Jenny Lewis is in the band, but the duet song is Jen Wood, not Jenny Lewis.
And it's also become like such a, like when Death Cab on their last tour, Jenny Lewis opened for them, and in the encore, they played Nothing Better every night
sang the Jen Wood parts.
And like when I saw them live, obviously Jenny Lewis sang the lead line. It's very weird.
So, now, don't get me wrong. Jen Wood is very good, and her vocals on Nothing Better are awesome. It's just you have Jenny Lewis right there.
They also, we were talking a bit about this last night. They sound quite similar in their vocals. Like, I actually did not know it wasn't Jenny Lewis.
Yeah, like you can't tell you can't tell there's a change from the harmonies on earlier songs, and then Nothing Better comes along. If you weren't paying attention, or you weren't looking for Jenny Lewis to come on a track, you might not notice. Nothing Better is pretty clearly based on Don't You Want Me by the Human League. Like it's similar, and Gibbard has copped to it before. Like a couple of the reviews of the album were like, this is Don't You Want Me. And he was like, yeah, that was the inspiration. Lyrically, it's a tough, tough song, because basically it's like, well, Gibbard wants to stay together, and Jen Wood's like, nah.
I love the way like the... it's like a that's like a dialogue the way the lyrics work. And she like when she steps in, she's like, excuse me, sir.
I have the lyric here because it is it is the most me breakup line there could possibly be. You're getting carried away feeling sorry for yourself with these revisions and gaps in history. So let me help you remember. I've made charts and graphs that should finally make it clear. I've prepared a lecture on why I have to leave. Maybe this is why I don't date. If you ever date me, there will probably be a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Spreadsheet at some point.
Jen
Wood having a spreadsheet ready to go to explain why this relationship is over is extremely my shit. There is one part of the song I have issue with. I love this song. But at one point, Gibbard sings, and I will block the door like a goalie tending the net in the third quarter of a tied game rivalry. What fucking sport is this?
And the Gibbard's a sport guy. Like, he's a big basketball guy. I see him tweeting, or when he had Twitter, he would tweet about fantasy baseball all the time. Like, he knows.
There are no sports that have a third quarter and a goalie other than lacrosse.
Maybe he was trying to just like, he's like, all right, I get it. Indie Music Fans 2003. You guys all like to say sports ball.
Yeah.
I'll relate to you.
Yeah.
He's like a
hand egg.
He's like one of those guys who's like a hidden, like a closeted sports fan. It's like, oh no, actually, I love baseball.
It occurs to me now I should have queued up Nothing Better before we talked about it, but here's Nothing Better.
Will someone please call a surgeon who can crack my ribs and repair this broken heart that you're deserting for better company? I can't accept that it's over, and I will block the door like a goalie tending the net in the third quarter of a tied game rivalry. Tell me, am I right to think that there could be
tie game rivalry?
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
Of a tied game rivalry.
Come on, Ben. If there was ever the intersection of our respective other work and this show.
Yeah. The closest I can come is maybe it's lacrosse that he's talking about, but I think he's just
mixing metaphors.
Yeah. Which is... I appreciate the effort.
I mean, like, far from us to criticize Ben Gibbard, but...
Yeah. Yeah. Now, like, I don't think it would have fit, like, and I will block the door, like, Bismack Biyombo in the 2016 Eastern Conference Finals. Like, I just don't think that fits, and I mean, it hadn't happened
maybe
yet.
Maybe we should make our own posters, but it's just about the 2016 Raptors.
Or the 2019 Raptors.
That's true.
Yeah.
2019, it's all just about, oh, we had a great thing. It's just this song. We had a great thing going, and now you're gone.
Yeah, it was seamless. It was perfect. Yeah. And then we're out of here. We're not reuniting. Yeah, we'll tease it a while, and that's about it. Then July 5th comes around, and Jenny Lewis has been traded to Rilo Kiley, and Transatlanticism comes out.
Yeah, and it's all fine.
So, Nothing Better. Somehow the album gets sadder. Then here's a spreadsheet on why I'm leaving you. So on the track Clark Gable, it's kind of about, you know, making home movies with an ex. But lyrically, it's just like this beautiful, sad song about knowing that this is what you want. And like he's talking to this ex and he's trying to capture these moments that he thought it would be like. And it's just not there. And he doesn't know if it's ever going to be there. And it's sad, man.
It's funny. We were just giving him shit for his sports metaphor. But like this whole song is just an amazing metaphor with film.
Yeah. And so the lyrics go, I want so badly to believe that there is truth, that love is real, and I want life in every word to the extent that it's absurd. Do you ever get the fear that your perfect verse is just a lie you tell yourself to help you get by? And like, that's the spirit of this song. And it's kind of the spirit of half the album.
Yeah.
Of just like, I want this. And I know that this is what it's supposed to be. and it's just not there. And I don't know if it's
like, yeah, there's a certain amount of like disillusional wish fulfillment, I think, is how I'd call the lyrical themes of the record, which again, you look at what Gibbard was writing with Death Cab at this time and it totally fits in with.
Yeah. Clark Abel is the most Death Cab song.
For sure. A movie script ending was on the photo album a year before this came out.
Yeah.
Or 2 years before this came out. And it's like, it's very, all of his lyrics seem very much in line with how he writes. But I think because it's against this stark digital background, you're like, oh, you're really good at this.
Yeah. And it's, the digital background gives it an interesting twist where it's very sad, but it sounds like this.
I grease the lens and frame the shot.
I have a weird thing with, there's certain songs that have like in the recording, there's like a hand clap or something that like bands recreate in their own way. Like when we talk about the Constantines, they have this whole hand clap part, but there's the one moment in that song where he goes, the marker snaps and there's just a hand clap, and live, he did it and the entire band clapped. And I don't know why, I was like, that was the coolest fucking thing in the world. I love that.
The choreography and the timing of that.
Yeah. And it's just such a quick little moment.
Those songs are the sadder songs.
Yes. Clark Gable, I remember in high school, devastating me.
Yeah. Nothing Better is pretty devastating too, but it's like quirky.
Yeah.
And
it's like the slower tune. It was like, yeah. Clark Gable's this bouncy tune. It's like, oh, this is also so sad.
Yeah. Nothing Better leaves me with so many questions. Like what type of graphs are we talking about? There is one happier song on the album, which is unusual for Gibbard. Such Great Heights was one of the last songs written and put together. It came together very, very quickly. It also has kind of a weird, cool music video that Apple basically stole.
Right.
So the music video for Such Great Heights is kind of in a like microchip factory, and then you zoom out and it's something else, and you zoom out and it's something else. And Apple loved the video and hired the exact same director, and they basically did the same video. And Death Cab was pissed. They didn't give their consent. It obviously gave the illusion that the Postal Service was connected to Apple. They were eventually compensated, kind of. Tamburello told Pitchfork that they got, quote, a little bit of stuff. Attention on iTunes and stuff like that. It was kind of weird.
That is weird.
It is weird. Such Great Heights, however, was their biggest breakthrough song. The Iron and Wine cover was in the trailer for Garden State.
Yes.
Which let's put a pin in the Garden State until a couple minutes from now. No, I want to talk about it today. It's going to be too big a diversion. And so let's stay on Such Great Heights. So Gibbard told Q Point, I certainly have written things that I felt were beamed down to me from somewhere else. And they're some of the best songs I think that I've written. Some of the most well-known and appreciated songs I've written, something like I Will Follow You Into the Dark, or Such Great Heights, were songs that I wrote incredibly quickly. After weeks of banging my head against the wall trying to write songs, those songs, when I wrote them, seemingly came out of nowhere. It did feel that there was some sort of spiritual transcendence happening and the song being beamed down to me. But at the end of the day, I wrote those songs. Yeah, of course you wrote those songs. No one beamed Such Great Heights down to you.
I sort of know what he means, though. Like,
yeah, sometimes you go on autopilot and like you've been trying. Look, I'm not a songwriter, but I'm a writer. Sometimes it just it flows and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes writing is a painstaking process, and then apparently for this album, it just was not.
Yeah, totally.
Such Great Heights is their biggest breakthrough. Obviously, the Iron and Wine cover. It has over 80 million Spotify streams, which I thought was a lot.
Yeah.
I looked and I'm like, oh, 80 million streams. That's... this must be one of the most popular Spotify songs.
Oh, not no, even close. Not even close.
There are songs getting like a billion streams now.
But for a band like The Post Service, that's a lot of streams.
Yeah, especially like a 2003 track.
Yeah.
To be getting streamed that much.
In their live show, and they toured it, they mostly, more or less, jumbled the album, because they only have the one album, so like they more, the set list was more or less the album kind of jumbled up.
Right.
But they put this second last. You can tell it was like, we're saving Such Great Heights, obviously.
Yeah. It gets picked up. It's used in a Veronica Mars episode.
Ooh,
which
I know you love your Veronica Mars.
I do love my Veronica Mars. I can't believe that in the Motion City soundtrack episode, I did not mention the lyric, because it's not on Commit This Memory.
It's true.
But the lyric, I fell asleep watching Veronica Mars again.
Relatable. Did that speak to you?
Yeah. Yeah. When he said that, I felt that shit. So Such Great Heights gets used in some commercials as well. Basically, the Postal Service had no issue about that. They were like, hey, like, we made this song. Why don't we make a little money off of it? It got covered by pretty much everyone. Ben Folds has done like a really cool, weird cover of it for Alt J's like a version where he's like playing forks and tinfoil and stuff as part of it. Rilo Kiley have covered it. There are like chiptune bands that have covered it. Ukulele band. Yeah, like a, there's a ukulele cover on YouTube. There is also Jake. A ska cover of Such Great Heights by Tip the Van.
Man, that kicks ass.
It's so good, right?
That's so good. That's not at all. When you were like Skocker, I was like, oh no.
Yeah. Well, there is a Streetlight Manifesto version also.
Okay.
That one was more probably what you were expecting.
Yeah, that ruled.
It was great.
I want to go listen to that now.
We are going to talk about how Give Up was received after this. All right, so Give Up is a very good album, and it was mostly received as such. It was successful enough that the band decided to support the album with a tour. Gibbard was a little worried about the stage show, so they had like small videos on the screen for each song to try to help that play up. You saw them in their reunion, right?
Yes. I didn't see them originally.
Okay, yeah. He was a little worried about like a guy just singing while there's another guy on the computer.
Right. Fair.
The touring was successful enough that they were getting bumped to bigger venues a lot. They had to add some second nights in some cities. People liked it. People really responded to it. It was certified gold in 2005. It was certified platinum in 2012 with over 1 million copies sold. It was Sub Pop's most successful release since Nirvana's debut, Bleach, in 1989.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's
Sub Pop.
Cool.
I also didn't realize that Bleach had been released on Sub Pop.
Yeah. Why do I know that? I did know that when I was younger, and I don't know why.
It peaked at 114 on the US Billboard 200, but in 2013, the 10th anniversary re-release hit number 45. So the re-release did way better.
Yes.
There are a lot of weird nuggets like that with this album where, like, because you have to remember in 2003, these labels are trying to figure out how to roll out albums with online being a thing now.
Right.
For kind of the first time. So one of the things that they did was they put up, I can't remember if it was Such Great Heights or The District Sleeps Tonight, but they put up one of the songs like for free download. And it was downloaded like 9 million times or something like that. So the reviews were mostly positive. I won't say they were overwhelmingly positive because there were a lot of like, hey, it's really good, but, or despite this, it's really good.
Right.
One Rolling Stone review said, quote, it has enough transcendent moments to forgive its few substandard tracks and ungodly lyrical blunders.
I'm not sure.
I mean, other than the goalie line. How dare you?
Never going to let it go.
Sir, how dare you? Or ma'am. Another Rolling Stone review, though, called it a cuddly new wave reverie and that Tamburello fits Gibbard's whimsy perfectly.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Yeah. Entertainment Weekly said Gibbard radiates claustrophobia. It's a near perfect pop recorded that has, oh, that is worded poorly. Anyway, the point that they're trying to say is that at that time, it was the kind of pop success that had eluded Death Cab up to that point.
I wonder how, like, because reviews tend to be influenced by the success of the artist they are reviewing, I wonder if this had come out, like, 2 years later, how it would have been received.
Yeah, after Transatlanticism. Yeah.
I wonder if it would have been more like, oh, what an interesting departure for massive Death Cab success. Instead, it's just like,
the best reviews, or the ones that I felt were most accurate, kind of noted that, like, hey, this isn't as strong as Dintel's album where he had everyone on it, and it's probably not as strong as the best Death Cab stuff, but it's pretty good. And it's unique to each of those people and to Jenny Lewis. Jenny Lewis is not featured heavily in a lot of the reception to this because
I didn't, until they toured with her, I didn't know she was part of it. Like, I remember when this came out, it was like, oh, this is Ben Gibbard and the Dintel guy.
Yeah. As the episodes we've done tend to, this was more favorably looked at after a period of time passed. Pitchfork listed it at number 104 on their top 200 albums of the 2000s. Rolling Stone called it, ranked it number 86 in their top 100 of the decade.
Huh.
So pretty good. Produced three singles, Such Great Heights, The District Sleeps Alone Tonight, and We Will Become Silhouettes. We Will Become Silhouettes actually was their top charting single. We Will Become Silhouettes hit number 3 in Canada.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
It was number 82 on the US Billboard Hot 100, number 92 on the UK singles chart. It was used in the trailer for Funny People, the Adam Sandler movie. The band had kind of joked that Such Great Heights would be their quote-unquote hit. It hit number 21 on the US Hot 100 singles sales, but it didn't chart super heavily. Part of the reason, I think, is that, you know, if you look back at the way things were charting was measured then, like, again, it's this weird moment where everyone's trying to figure out how to do online.
Yeah.
And Sub Pop.
Well, as you said, if it was downloaded like 9 million times, they wouldn't understand.
Yes, it was downloaded 9 million times by 2005. Radio stations had told them that they feared a high burn factor. So basically, like, people would get tired of the song pretty quickly. That was not the case. It remained very successful for a really long time.
Huh.
Gibbard told Sub Pop in 2013, I felt like we just captured lightning in a bottle. I think it is continuing with the tradition of electronic pop that was popular when we were kids in the 80s and that people kind of walked away from for almost 20 years. If not the first, we were certainly the first visible act to revive this genre and kind of modernize it in a way that was a reflection of kids who grew up on Pavement, but also grew up on New Order and Pet Shop Boys and whatever else. Nobody had checked off those boxes on the same record.
To his point, I think I'm sure that, like, the electronic music genre wasn't new when they did this, but I think it's fair that, like, this mainstream indie pop version of it probably wasn't around as much.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's, you know, why it's looked at pretty favorably, other than being a really good album. It still kind of stands out. So in the aftermath, everyone goes back to their individual products, projects. Also products. We're all products.
We're all products. Commodities.
We exist under capitalism. In 2007, they began work on a new album, but it never really got off the ground. Death Cab getting as big as they did was a bit of a sticking point just in terms of scheduling. The plan was, which makes me super curious what this album would have sounded like, Jenny Lewis was going to be a lot more involved in the writing process and I think a bigger part of the band because she was added so late. And I'm really curious. Yeah. I want to know what that would have sounded like. Tamborello told Pitchfork in 2008, "The Postal Service is a really nice outlet. It's so fun to do. Changing it too much or even overthinking it, I just don't want to make it a drag to work on." So once it became not as easy and seamless as Give Up, they were kind of like, you know what? This is, it's not going to happen. They never really like officially said anything about it, but it was like one of these jokes of like, oh, it's their, it's your Chinese democracy. Like 20 years later, it's going to come out or however many years. So in 2013, they reissued Give Up. I mentioned it charted pretty well, the reissue. They released two new tracks.
I was hoping you were going to bring these up. These two tracks bother me a little bit because I think they're so good. And
again, like what would a second one have sounded like?
Like Turn Around, which is one of those songs, is amazing. And I'm so upset we didn't get whatever that second album that sounded like that was going
to
be.
Yeah, that would have been nice to get a whole album of that.
Yeah.
Part of the reason that they wanted to retour it was Gibbert felt very little ownership of it because he'd, quote, basically made it and then put it away. So he had to focus on Death Cab, and Transatlanticism came out a couple months later. And then it was like, oh yeah, the Postal Service is in the rear view. Like that's a thing I did.
Right.
And it's not the thing I do anymore. And it's not who I am. So this was a way, the reissue and the shows were a way for him to kind of re-experience it with people the way people had experienced it, because he felt like he hadn't been a part of that. And then in 2013, they were like, you know what? Let's just confirm it. We're done. It's not coming. Stop holding your breath. Sigh.
Man, that show was so good.
Do you remember who they played with?
I remember there was an opener who was okay. And I had heard of, but I forgot who it was. But the line, it was Gibbard and Tamborello and Jenny Lewis. And oh, I forget her name and I shouldn't. She's from the Mina Birds and Georgie James. Laura Burhan is her name. So it's four of them. They added such a oomph, for lack of a better term, to these songs. They're so meaty live. Like they really added a lot. It was a lot faster. They had Gibbard would hop
bigger
on
arrangements.
Bigger arrangements. Gibbard would hop on a live drum kit occasionally and sing. And I remember they closed the main set with Natural Anthem, and that build at the beginning of that, I remember being like, that was like, whoa. It was such a good show. I think about that show all the time.
Okay, so that's not Garden State. So we have this ranking / debate segment that is loosely defined and we can do whatever with it. I didn't want to do this to you, Jake, but I kicked around the idea of we would rank the Garden State soundtrack songs. Boy, is that a trip going to look at the Garden State soundtrack. And like that movie has such a weird place in like on the film side. But also, like, it was revered as this incredible soundtrack. It's extremely early 2000s. We are not going to rank and debate the Garden State soundtrack.
We might do an episode about it someday, though.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are going to be some bonus episodes in the future, maybe, and we're going to get into some stuff like soundtracks. So we're not going to debate that. We're not going to rank those. We're just going to talk about our favorite songs on the album. I have a top five listed. I mean, there are only 10 tracks, so... Jake, what's your favorite song?
You know, I'm torn on this one.
Okay.
My first instinct is The District Sleeps Alone Tonight, only because it's like, A, it's the first track, so it's the first exposure to the band.
It's got that nice ASMR open.
It's got that great ASMR
open. As I did
open.
Off the top so well, clearly.
This is one of the records, like, I remember exactly where I was when I heard this the first time.
Right.
There used to be a ferry from Rochester, New York to Toronto. And I was on the ferry and I heard this album the first time. I can like see it. But I think that no longer is my favorite song on this record. I think if we're doing a top five, I think I go Clark Gable, Natural Anthem, We'll Become Silhouettes, then District, and then probably Brand New Colony.
Okay. We have very different top fives. That's great.
Interesting.
Clark Gable is my favorite song on the album. I think that it's just a really good song. Yeah. Maybe we played it and talked about it earlier.
I think it's one.
It's hard not to come away from that song sad.
Yeah.
Which is the whole point, right?
I think if you were to ask me to do like a top five Ben Gibbard list,
it would probably crack.
It would probably be the only Postal Service song that would be in that list.
Yeah. So then it's your top one off this album.
Yeah.
Then, I guess. I guess we're in agreement then. I really like Nothing Better. I think that's my second favorite one. And then like after that, it's Such Great Heights and The District Sleeps Alone Tonight in some order. And then my favorite like non-single or one we haven't talked about is Sleeping In. I really like Sleeping In.
That's interesting. That's like the one on the album that doesn't do much for me.
Yeah, I kind of figured you wouldn't like that one. It's not a very Jake song.
No, it's not. I don't know why. That one never clicked with me. Yeah, like and as it. We said, if Turnaround was on...
Yes.
This, which I know it's like a new quote-unquote song.
Yeah, I would have it behind Clark Gable still.
Yeah, me too.
But it would be in the mix there, two, three, four somewhere. I guess that kind of makes the mixtape choice easy, Clark Gable.
Yeah, I guess I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it's a non-single and it's both of our favorite songs.
Yeah.
I feel like that's
pretty cut and dry.
This is the easiest decision we've had to make for the mixtape. Jake, I think that's pretty much it on the Postal Service.
I think so.
Do you have... I mean, you got your concert story in.
Yeah.
Do you have more takes on?
Not really. I mean, it's the only thing I will say is that it's aged extremely well. Like we were kind of joking about the Garden State soundtrack and how some of early 2000s indie rock has not aged particularly well. Some of it has. This album, I think, because of its electronic leaning, has aged extremely well. And you could, if this came out today, I think it would be just as popular and successful, if not more so. Which I don't think you can say about a lot of early 2000s indie rock.
Yeah, that's probably accurate.
But yeah, I love this record. I think it's great. And I'm happy we got to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm so torn. I know we just like lamented the lack of a second album, but it's kind of like, cute's not the right word for me, but it just like, it kind of feels nice that there was only one and it like captured this moment and fit that moment really well. And it's cool to go back to. And like, if they had made multiple albums, like maybe releasing a new one in 2013, that's enough time and space between. But like, I don't know if they had kept making these albums, if this one would feel the way it feels.
Yeah, I actually like, I definitely have more of an appetite for another Postal Service tour than I do for another Postal Service album, if that makes sense.
Give me a Postal Service tour where Jenny Lewis plays and then Death Cab plays and then...
Oh, it's the Postal Service. Hell yeah.
But I mean, he would be exhausted by the end.
That would be good.
Yeah, it was like how Boy Genius played. It was like, oh... We're going to do...
Play our own sets.
A Lucy Dacus, Phoebe Bridgers, and then a Julian Baker, and then we'll close it with Boy Genius. Oh, just do that.
You know what?
Every supergroup should tour like that.
Like a Jenny Lewis, Ben Gibbard poster show, I would pay a lot of money for.
Yeah. And Alkaline Trio should open for Blake. All right. So Chris Wall is kind of the unsung hero, not of this, but maybe of a lot of what Gibbard
of
is doing.
Early 2000s indie rock?
Yeah. So not only did he help produce the Gibbard sides of these, and he was in Death Cab for Cutie, he produced a ton of other good stuff too. He produced The Thermals, Someone Still Loves You, Boris Yeltsin, Gord Downie's solo project, Tegan and Sarah, Not a Surf. All right, we won't tease it any more than that. We won't even tell you what album it's going to be.
Please try the fish.